originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I'm joining you tonight from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studio. Thank you to everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219 XM 201, and also to those of you listening to our website at www.horseracingradio.net. As you know, a portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. Please visit their website if you're able to help at www.pdjf.org. So our guest tonight, he won the Preakness in 2005 with a thrilling and blood-pumping finish aboard a Fleet Alex. He went on to win the Belmont that year, of course, as well. Other top mounts include Hava de Grace, Bulls Bay, Ben's Cat, just to name a few. It was just announced that he is making a return to Delaware Park, the track where he found much of his success, with 2,609 wins, over $78 million in earnings and counting. It's a pleasure to introduce jockey Jeremy Rose. Jeremy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Christina. How are you doing?
I'm great. I'm so excited. Yeah, I haven't seen you in a very long time. We rode together in Maryland, and I am so excited to hear that you're going back to Delaware.
Yeah, it feels good to be back in that circuit area where, you know, you got the tri-state area, Maryland, Philly, and Delaware, all in that small area.
Yeah, there's so many opportunities there. You can ride pretty much day and night if you so wish. And I'm assuming you've been out hustling in the mornings. And who've you been working for so far?
A lot for Anthony Pecoraro there. I think Delaware's going to be a lot of shipping business, but he's got a full barn there. Paul McCullen's there. And we're starting to get some more horses to come on the backside, you know, I mean, starting Wednesday. So just starting to line horses up and line, you know, shipping business in.
That's awesome. You have to be really excited.
Yeah, I'm very excited. You know, I'm excited to get back with, I have my original agent back again,
wow.
A kid. He had me from, you know, 01 till, I want to say 2011, something like that, you know, when I left Delaware. So it's great to get back with him on that circuit. And, you know, both of us kind of have contacts in that area, anywhere from New York down to Maryland. So we're both, I think, excited to get the meet going.
Yeah, definitely. And you guys had so much success together. And where have you been the past couple years?
Well, I went out to Indiana and had one of the top agents out there, Jimmy McCurney, and had a good meet out there, and then came back this way, and then just kind of hung around this area. I grew up near Bellefonte area, which is only about an hour and a half from Penn National. So I kept shipping back and forth, just kind of riding Penn National for about 9-10 months, then a little bit in New York, kind of all over the place.
Wow, yeah, I'd say so. And yeah, living the gypsy life of a jockey, sounds like. And I hear you're engaged.
Yeah, that's why, you know, it's nice to get back in one area where I can ride a bunch of different tracks. The whole, you know, as riding 7 days a week and all over the country, it's kind of hard to have a life like this. And yeah, I've been dating my fiance for about 2.5 years now. Her name's Brittany Watson, and she's got a little 3-year-old, so yeah, the family life is kind of suiting me now.
That's wonderful. Congratulations. How did you two meet?
Actually, it kind of worked out. My mom kept one of her jump horses at her farm, and I just kind of met her here. We were shipping a friend's horse over here to board and just kind of started helping her out over here, playing around because, you know, it's night races, so it gave me something to do. Playing, just kind of hobbying around on her X-race horses that she's turned into to pleasure horses. They're a little calmer than I'm used to, and not quite as exciting, but it gives me something to do. So one thing led to another, and from there on, we just kind of started. I'm not sure, we put a date on when we started dating, but we kind of started seeing each other before that, just so we had an anniversary, so that's how it kind of began.
That's wonderful. I'm so happy for you, Jeremy, and yeah, you have great things in your future, definitely sounds like. And let's talk about, you mentioned your mom. She lives not too far from Penn National. And did you grow up there?
I grew up, well, where we're at now at Spring Mills. We have a house there. Where I grew up was Belfont, which is just over the other side of Center Hall Mountain. That's where I grew up. That, you know, I stayed there for, you know, my first 18 years till I graduated high school, and then, you know, found racing a couple years after that.
And then, so your mom, has she always been involved with horses?
Yeah, we've always been doing the pleasure thing. I started out with the quarter horses when I was real young and, you know, did that until probably 12 or 13 years old and got out of the horses for a while and started into the sports scene and doing high school sports. And then, you know, kind of did the wrestling, and that was what I was planning on doing, is going from high school into college wrestling. And, a lot of people don't know that I knew nothing about racing at the time, but a couple of guys that were wrestling in Ohio State passed away from cutting too much weight, so they moved the weight from 118 to 126, and I wasn't big enough to make Division I wrestling. I was too small. So a friend of the family, Bob Zeiler, who just passed away this year, took me in the racetrack, and just by chance it worked out.
Yeah, I'd say so. It did, Jeremy. And so you were, from what I hear, just such a talented wrestler. And it's unfortunate, in a way, they changed the weights. But I guess it's really a good thing. But it's funny because I've talked to so many other jockeys who actually, that's kind of how they got involved with sports, is wrestling. And why do you think that is?
Well, there's a couple different reasons. One, wrestling, like any type of physical act like that, wrestling, boxing, is all weighted thing, you know, so you're kind of on the same platform as everybody wrestling. There's a certain weight that you can wrestle at, and we're all kind of small for the most part, you know, wrestlers and also jockeys. Obviously, there's a top weight that you can have and a bottom weight, so, and the balance transfers over, and I think a big plus to all that is the balance and the ability to keep your weight down and know how to stay fit and keep a healthy weight at a small stature. You know, you have your tall jockeys, but for the most part, I don't think there's too many over, you know, 5'6", 5'7". You know, we're in that range of 5 foot to 5'7", 113 to 118 is about as big as we get. So I think wrestling's one of those things that just transfers over really easy if you have horse sense to racing.
Yeah, that does make sense. You mentioned the balance, and I've never really thought about that, but when you're wrestling someone and you're trying to stay your center of gravity, I mean, it really does make sense.
Yeah, you know, your balance is a huge thing in wrestling, you know, and the balance of the horse, obviously, you've been on one is, and I think the way a wrestler carries his weight and throws his weight around is a big advantage on the back of a racehorse also. You know, when you're in stride with a horse, you want to make it as easy on them to carry your weight, and I think wrestling is a lot about, you know, ability to transfer weight back and forth.
So give us your highlights of your wrestling career.
Well, actually, I didn't even start wrestling until 10th grade. I was walking down the hallway one day, and Coach Johnson pulled me aside, and he needed a 3-pounder. And at the time, I was like 98 pounds. I mean, I was little.
Wow.
And I didn't want to do it because, to me, they wore tights and you're grabbing a guy. I don't want to do that. So just come back to the wrestling room. Just come back and try it out. And they beat me from one side of the room to the other. Just beat on me. I loved it. I loved every bit of it. I came out bloody. I had bruised eyes. And I was beat up. I was exhausted. And I was hooked from that point on. I mean, by far, I played pretty much every sport there was. By far, wrestling is my favorite sport. And so the first year I went 6-18, got pinned a lot. And then went to a bunch of camps because I had to be a lot of these kids kind of like racing start early. You know, a lot of these kids start 16 to race. I didn't start till 21. Wrestling, they started 4 or 5 years old. I didn't start till 15. So I had to catch up. My next year, I went 29-6 and made it to regionals. And then the year after that, I think I went 43-6 43-3. I went to states to the quarterfinals. Got beaten. I think I could have probably won states. So I just kind of choked at the big time that year. But you know, I enjoyed it a lot. Made a lot of strides to get to that point. And Pennsylvania is known as kind of the top wrestling state in the country. A lot of the college programs look to Pennsylvania to get their high school wrestlers out to college. So this is the toughest state to wrestle in.
Wow. And then just after they changed the weights, that there was just no chance you could have done it, so you had to look elsewhere.
Yeah, a lot of people say, well, you're 100, at the time, you're riding 116, 117, you couldn't put on a couple pounds, but what they don't realize, if you're wrestling a 126-pound person, a lot of them are coming down from 140 pounds.
Mm.
You're wrestling a lot bigger people. So I might be going up in weight, but they're coming down, and that's a lot of weight to deal with. And you're looking at 10, 15-pound swing. And in Division I, you got to be the best in the country, and it just wasn't going to work for me.
Yeah, that definitely does make sense. Like we said, it worked out. And so describe your first racetrack experience and why you were hooked.
Well, first racetrack experience was with Bob Zeiler, and I just went up there and watched the people working horses and galloping. And to me, it didn't look all that difficult. Now, you and I both know it's a lot more difficult than watching little horses run around a racetrack. But at the time, I looked at it and said, I think I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
So from that point on, he told me that, other friends of the family knew people in Puerto Rico. So I went to Puerto Rico for almost a year just breaking babies.
Wow.
And galloping a couple horses at El Caminante racetrack in Puerto Rico. And actually, I know a lot of it, like J.D. Acosta, Louis Garcia, they knew me from that school. I couldn't go through the school because it was a two-year school, but they knew me from Greg and Linda Jackson, which is a farm where I broke babies. And then from there, I was sent up here, and I got in with, I don't know if you remember Mike and Nick Pietro?
Yeah.
But that's the only outfit I ever worked for. I worked for them for 2 years, and they're the ones that really gave me the foundation to gallop horses, and of course Nikki taught me the basics of race riding.
Yeah, great guys. And Puerto Rico, that's quite, you must have really been convinced, I guess, to make that kind of a move, to go there.
Yeah, I was kind of, at the time, I didn't really want to go to college. So the fact that I wasn't a big school person, I didn't like school work. I just wanted to go for wrestling. So once that was out, I knew I had to find something athletic to do, because that's just what I was lucky to be given, is athletic talent. So I had to find something in that realm. So I took a shot, and luckily everything kind of worked out in my favor.
That had to be a bit of a culture shock, however.
Oh, terrible culture shock. Didn't know anybody. Never left really other than to wrestle. Never left my hometown. Never been on an airplane, and my parents drove me to the airport, gave me a hug, and down to Puerto Rico I went. No, nobody. So it was a culture shock, but Greg and Linda Jackson, they treated me like family. I stayed right there at the farm and worked at the farm, broke babies at the farm. They really took me in under their wing, and I got lucky with the Pietros, too, because coming in, it was my first racetrack to ever go to, my first job, and my only job I ever had of galloping. So it worked out.
How old were you when you went to Puerto Rico?
I want to say 18. 18, maybe turned 19. So, yeah, it was a culture shock.
I can't imagine. And when you first arrived, I'm assuming since you didn't really have a lot of experience around racehorses, did they start you working in the barn, or did you pretty much just start out riding right away?
No, they threw me right on their babies. And when I say babies, it's not like, I'm used to now with the people. Like, they came from a farm and they're broke and we got them on the track and see how they handle it. These were babies that never saw cats, like babies.
Oh, wow.
And threw me up. I think my record was, I think I went all 3 days without getting dropped. That was my record. So on a daily basis, I got laid out at the farm there. It was, luckily I was young and didn't get hurt often and could take quite a bit of pain, because I hit the ground a lot that year.
Jeez, and you still wanted to do it even after all that.
I never really got the fear factor. It was mm-hmm. more fun. I got aggravated because I kept getting dropped. After a while that gets to you, but you just get back on and do it again. One thing I was always taught is, even young, when you fall off, you gotta get back up again.
That's exactly right. Now, how far along would you take these horses? Would you get them galloping and breezing on the racetrack?
Well, what we would do, we would get them, we get our fresh horses in. We usually put about 60 days on there at the farm in groups and take them on the trail rides and get them used to people and all that. And then once that group is ready, we'd take them to the racetrack to basically show the owner or trainer, whoever it was at the time, that the job was done. You could gallop around, and then they would keep them there at the track, and they would take over. We never really breeze them. Okay. I never breeze a horse until I'm at the Petros.
Mm. So then after – how long were you in Puerto Rico for?
Almost a year. I want to say 10 months I think I was there.
So then why did you decide to come back to the States at that point?
Well, my mom was starting to work for Purina, and she was starting – and she sells – she's a feed manager on the racetrack, so – she was starting to get connections on the racetrack, and one of her fellow dealers knew the Petros. And he said that if you want a family atmosphere, as in where you're safe, your son's safe on the racetrack, and we know how that can be, this is where you want to go. And if they need a rider at that time. So it was kind of one of those things that I either made the move then, or I had to wait for something else, or, you know, might have to wait a long time. So the opportunity came up, so I packed my stuff and moved to Delaware.
Back to Delaware. And what was it like getting on the racetrack, starting to breeze horses, gallop horses on the racetrack?
A whole new atmosphere, I guess I could say. You know, it wasn't so much staying on the back now. It was learning how to hold a horse, get them to relax, you know, get them, you know, using their body correctly. Of course, breezing, getting your times right, you know, knowing how fast you're going, you know, how much horse you had, that type of thing. It was another, you know, after the year of breaking babies, it was another 2 years of galloping before they felt I was ready, and I certainly wasn't sure if I was ready at that point, but that that was a good 3 years of getting on horses before I ever rode a race.
Yeah, it's so important to have that good foundation. And how was your weight? I mean, you've never, ever had to struggle with your weight, so you weren't ever really worried about that time-wise, right?
No, I was pretty lucky. You know, I always had a high metabolism, and, you know, again, the wrestling background, I knew how to pull weight when needed. You know, I knew how to lose. I knew how to work out. I knew how to do things like that. You know, obviously getting older nowadays, weight's becoming more of an issue, but I'm certainly not fighting it like a lot of jockeys do. I don't know how some of them do it.
Yeah, that's not fun for sure.
No, you know that.
I know exactly how that goes. And you're what? You're 5 feet tall?
Yeah, 5 feet with shoes on.
Because
when I went to go get my driver's license, I was 4'11 and a half, and I asked him if I could put my shoes on so I could at least have 5 foot on my driver's license.
That's hilarious. But hey, it works out for what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's no point in being tall at this point. I take my career choice. So if they want to give me tall back when I was in high school, that's fine, but not now.
Jockey Jeremy Rose joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Jeremy, you said that after 2 years of galloping, well, prior to that, a year with babies, 2 years galloping, the Petros felt you were ready. You weren't quite sure, but were they the first ones to name you on a horse?
Yep, they put me on my first horse, Daly's Princess. She went off 9-5. She went by 4 or 5 lengths, and the whole jockey's room waited around for me to paint me. I think everybody knew I was going to win the race. You know, the Petros, they're like family. They took very good care of me. They kept me safe. And, you know, they basically put me on a hang on right out of the gate. You know, they made sure that I got that first win out of the way. And then after that, I could learn, you know, more about racing.
And how did that feel to win your first race? I mean, I know how it is. Your first race is such a blur. I didn't win my first race, so I can't imagine combine that with it. It just had to happen so fast.
To be honest, I remember quite a bit of it. You know, everybody at Delaware Park at that time kind of knew the Petros, and they were all pretty friendly. So I had Bobby Greco. I was the outside post, which was great. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to worry about anybody coming over or anything like that. I had tactical feed, and the gate guys knew me. So they let me get set in. You know, it wasn't one of those walk in and bang the gate. They let me set in. You know, he told, I think it was Glenn at the time, said, "Glenn, give me a second. Got the horse squared up. Are you ready?" Yep, broke out. I remember the jockeys behind me yelling, "Okay, you're clear, you're clear." Basically, they helped me get around there. You know, I was a little scared. That, you know, obviously, it's my first race. I don't want to do anything stupid. The students were obviously watching me, like they should, you know, so I wanted to get my license. You know, at Delaware, I don't know if it's still like that, but I know when I started, you had to take a written test, you had to step in the steward's box for 3 days, you had to sit down at the starting gate for 3 days and watch everything, you know, and I think a lot of tracks should do stuff like that to make sure their young riders are ready, you know, to ride that first race, because it's, you know, it's dangerous out there. But that day, they had basically everything set up that, you know, for me to succeed that day. And I remember quite a bit of it.
Describe the initiation or the, you know, the celebration afterwards.
Well, the whole jockstrom waited for me. And I believe it was Guy Stevens at the time, tackled me from behind. Before that, they obviously got me with all the water and the shampoo and the manure and anything else they could find to put in the bucket. But, of course, they painted me up in the jockstrom. I believe Michael McCarthy enjoyed that. But they all they painted me with absorbing and bluing, which they didn't tell me what absorbing was. I found that out when I hit the shower. And it wasn't very nice, but, you know, that's the initiation we do.
But you never forget it, even as maybe
never.
As crazy as it is, it's a great...
You remember everybody that was there? You remember your first win, her name, what race it was? You remember, or his name was depending on the horse, but, yep, I remember just about everything on that day.
And how quickly did success seem to find you, Jeremy? Did you just start winning right off the bat?
No. You know, at the plan after my first win was to start riding just a couple horses to get some experience. You know, you don't want to win your fifth race and not be somewhat polished that people want to use you. So I rode a couple horses that were just horses to learn, you know, set in the back, switch sticks, set mid-pack, maybe show some speed but die on you, you know, learn how to get them out of the gate, learn how to be in a group. And then I picked up a horse named Dumore, and Kid actually picked it up for me. He wasn't my agent at the time. They just needed a rider, and that horse, I think, was 20 or 30 to 1 and happened to win. And at that point, the teacher said, okay, you got 2 wins. You need to stop for a little bit. You know, we don't want you winning too many too quick and start your bug for not being ready. And I was all for that. So I went back down to Florida with the Petros and galloped for, I want to say, in the early February, I think. And Kate called me and Tim Ritchie. Well, actually, they called Mike Petro, and they wanted me to call up and start riding. And, you know, Mikey wanted to make sure that it was perfect situation for me. And Nikki wanted to make sure it was perfect situation. And, you know, they came and talked to me, and I said, well, I don't want to leave. You know, I like galloping. You know, I don't have to. It's Florida. It's February up north. I don't want to go. And Mikey pretty much said, you need to go. You know, Tim Ritchie's got 50 horses. He wins a lot of races. Kids ready to take your book. I said, are you sure? He's, yep. So I packed up. I think at the time I had a 98 old Mustang or something like that. And I drove from Florida up here to Delaware at the time. And my first workers were for Tim Ritchie at Fair Hill, which I'm sure you've been to Fair Hill, but in the middle of February, I've never been to anywhere colder than that. And I just left Florida. I had no winter clothes.
Oh, wow.
Because we went from Delaware to Florida, So I need winter clothes. So I was out basically in a long sleeve shirt, and it was snowing, sleeting. I had to work, I don't know, 3 or 4 for Tim Ritchie. So Kid made me on a couple horses for Tim, and I think I win 2 out of 3 the first day, win 1 out of 3, and then win like 3 the next. It was a whirlwind. And from that point, my bug year just snowballed, and it was just win after win after win.
I guess you're able to go buy a winter coat, right?
Yeah. I was going all right at that point. Yeah, I think we win all together. I think if you did the calendar year, I think we went 364 races that year and 312 for the Apprentice Eclipse Award. Success came pretty quick.
As you mentioned, you were the Eclipse Award winning apprentice in 2001. Quite the accomplishment. Do you remember who you beat out that year?
Not exactly. I remember Julian Pimentel was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Can't remember who exactly the other two were. I remember Julian Pimentel was one of them.
And describe to our audience, you mentioned the bug several times and you didn't want to start the bug too early, but mention to our audience what exactly that means and why you don't want to start, you know, win your fifth race too early.
Okay, well, the apprentice is what they call is a bug rider, and I think the reason is because we go around bug trainers for mounts. But basically what it is when you start out, you get 10 pounds off of whatever journeyman weight is on a horse. And the reason they give you that is because it gives you a reason for trainers to use you for the weight allowance because you don't have the experience a journeyman does. You know, obviously, if I'm a first-year rider and you got somebody like a Mario Pino that's won 6,000 races, if we're even with weight, you're going to take the guy with all the experience. So it gives a trainer a reason or owner a reason to ride that person. Now, after you win 5 races, that's when your bug starts. When you win that 5th race that day, you start your bug, and you have that for 1 year. And it goes from 7 to 5 pounds. I believe it's after 45 wins it goes to 5 pounds. So you get 10, 7, and 5 pounds off the journeyman's weight. And once you win that 5th race, you have 1 full year until you are basically thrown in with everybody else. You're just a journeyman jockey. And in that 1 year, you better make a name for yourself or at least establish yourself as a rider. Establish that you can ride at that level wherever you're at, and then you can ride with journeymen.
Do you think the weight matters, Jeremy?
Personally, no. I don't think it may. It may make a difference. Like, I know the one time I did think it made a difference, I rode Haverty Grace in the Cotillion, and there was always a horse named Blind Luck that kept beating me, and beating me by, like, a head or a neck, just drove me nuts. And I remember that race particular that Blind Luck got in with 124, and we got in with 114, and I made sure I made that weight because I thought that day that the weight might make a difference. But other than that, I don't think, you know, a couple pounds here or there makes much of a difference.
Well, Jeremy, we have to take a quick commercial break. Folks, stay with us. You are listening to Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Hi, I'm John Velasquez.
And I'm Julian Lepau. Every jockey knows and accepts the risk of a sport every time they get a leg up on the horse.
Although catastrophic on-track accidents are rare, when they do happen, the lives of the jockeys and their family change forever.
It's up to all of us in racing to support these men and women.
That's why we support the Permanent Disabled Jockey Fund. Since its founding in 2006, the PDJF has disbursed over $8 million to over 75 permanently disabled jockeys.
Over 90 cents out of every dollar donated goes directly to these brave men and women.
They use their monthly stipend to pay bills, hire caretakers, and many other things that make living with a permanent disability just a bit easier.
This is Mike Penna of HRRN. Did you know that the PDJF has no permanent guaranteed funding mechanism and relies entirely on donations from people like you? Please visit the PDJF website at pdjf.org to learn how you can help.
Hi, I'm Ron Turcotte. I support the PDJF. I hope you will too, and I thank you.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
And Scrappy T fights for the lead and makes it. It's Scrappy T at the 5/16 taking over High Limit, and a Fleet Alex has room to roll at the quarter pole. A Fleet Alex is coming after Scrappy T in the pre. Oh, Scrappy T taking out a Fleet Alex who almost went down. Scrappy T bearing out of the 3/16. A Fleet Alex, boy, does he have some heart. Look at him come back a furlong to go. And down to the final furlong in the Preakness. A Fleet Alex, Scrappy T. How much the best is he? A Fleet Alex strolling home. And the Preakness to win by 3. Scrappy T second and Giacomo third. A Fleet Alex, awesome.
Welcome back to Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host Christina McManigal, and I am joined tonight by jockey Jeremy Rose, and we just heard the thrilling replay of your victory aboard a Fleet Alex in the 2005 Preakness. Jeremy, what are you feeling right now? How I hope you're smiling after hearing that.
Still gives me goosebumps. I love Dave Rodman's call. He's one of the best. You know, he's called a lot of my races in Maryland, and you know, out of the 3 Triple Crown races, that's the one that I wanted to win by far, just because it's kind of home track where I started, you know, knew a lot of people there. So that win by far the most special one I have.
What? I mean, you probably weren't thinking when that happens because it's just instinct reaction. But whenever Scrappy T came out and he almost went down, what was going through your mind?
Well, I thought enough of it that when I was coming on the outside, I had just got through on the rail, and I figured at that point, no reason to go through on the inside remote. I had so much horse that it wasn't going to be very close race. I wasn't going to have to pull a stick out at that point. And I still remember the day, Ramon reaching, and I've ridden with Ramon for a decade, better part of a decade, so I knew, you know, Ramon very well. And I saw him reach with his left hand and pull across, and my dad went, no. And it's most of the time, horses don't duck out. I don't know why he yelled. I just knew it was bad. And when he hit him, and Scrappy, he switched to that right lead, and his butt kicked out, and that's when, you know, the whole horse's head and neck completely disappeared from me. You know, I didn't, everybody says about me, you know, staying on him, it had nothing to do with that. It just happened that Alex, as athletic as he was, he popped right up and hit me in the chest with his neck and head and put me back up in the saddle.
Wow.
You know, obviously if he doesn't come back up, neither do I.
Yeah, I mean, just so quick that he was able to recover. It was so amazing. And I know I've never seen anything like that before, especially not in the Preakness, such a, you know, prestigious race like that. But watching that race and just seeing your smile and, you know, you were so excited after the race. I can't imagine. You go from thinking one minute you're going down to the next minute you win the Preakness. I mean, that's a rush of emotions.
Yeah, it was amazing. You know, after he came up, even at that point, I said, well, I think we'd still win this from here. Because I knew that I was going to pass Scrappy T. The only thing I was worried about was a deep closer coming after me because it stopped my momentum so bad. But, you know, he recovered so quick, and there's a picture that it still amazes me to this day. I think I have it in my house over in Spring Mills, but you see his left leg underneath his chest, his right leg spread out, and his back two legs are completely spread wide open. It doesn't look like he should even be on his feet, and his nose is about 6 inches off the ground. And if you look, within the next stride, he's going past Scrappy T, and these are the best 3-year-olds that this country had to offer. You know, it was the best you could get, and he just destroyed them.
Tell us what he was like to ride.
He was... I keep saying it's like racing a Honda against a Porsche, you know. Basically, I don't think Alex, had I got a horse like Alex before him, I don't think he would ever got beat because the lack of experience got him beat in a couple races. There wasn't a horse, I can't ever remember a horse that was in front of me that he didn't pass. He had the fastest 3/8-mile kick of any horse that I've ever seen. He just was kind of like a quarter horse the last 3/8 miles. So if you use it at the right time, there wasn't a horse he couldn't get by.
How did you first get the mount on a Fleet Alex?
Well, at the time, I had Kid and Tim Ritchie in my corner, and I walked in the barn one day. It was right after the Timonium sale, I believe it is, and you know, everybody said how plain Alex looked, but for some reason, the first day I saw him, he just looked different than me. He wasn't big or huge or, you know, Bellamy Road-looking size or anything like that. He's only about 15'3", maybe 16 hands at the most. And it's just the way he's put together, and he just had that eye that he looked like he was smart. First time I worked them, you could tell this was a different kind of animal. I mean, first 3/8, there was no greenness about him. There was no babiness to him. You know, he was a 2-year-old, but he didn't act like a 2-year-old. He already knew kind of what the game was. So from day one, you know, you knew you were setting on something different.
And then tell us about the first race you rode.
Well, the first race was at Delaware Park, and, you know, a couple people asked me, we hear about this 2-year-old you had. And I said, yeah, I don't want to jinx it, I said, but I think as close as anyone's going to get is in the gate, honestly. I said, he's a monster, and there's a horse in there named Monster Chaser. And the guy that passed away recently, Eddie Gaudette, which I'm sure you remember, big-time Maryland trainer, brought him up. And we were always friendly, and he was always joking with me. And his horse just ran second at Maryland, you know, a pretty good main special weight. And he came up, and we were talking to Pat. He says, yeah, just sit back, make one run. He says, you can run second to us. I said, okay, I don't know about that. And top of the lane, I just gave him a little kiss, and I think he ran down there like 103 flat or something. It was unbelievable. You know, for a 2-year-old to run 5.5, it was fast.
Jeez.
So he won that one by about 12. So they got a race put off because Tim wanted to get one more race in him before we went up to New York. And it was in a flop, so we got to see something else from Alex. And he broke good, and he set his usual race mid-pack, and then he ran. I think he ran almost the exact same time again, went by another 12 and a half. So you could tell that you're setting on a real racehorse.
And then from there, he went to win the Sanford at Saratoga.
Yep, we went to Saratoga, won the Sanford. The hopeful, I hit him a couple times too much left cannon. We ended up winning, but it wasn't the prettiest win. So we won both our Saratoga starts.
And then where did you go from there?
Then we went to the Champagne, and that's where the lack of experience came in. We were setting a pretty good trip and everything, but Johnny B, being the rider he was, riding those races, he knew he had me inside, so he kind of held me in as long as he needed to. And I couldn't quite get by him. He beat me by, I want to say, a neck. And, you know, Kim Ritchie fought to keep me on him. And I got to ride him in the Breeders' Cup. And, again, pushed the button a little early on Alex. You know, I should have sat back and let him run his normal race. And it passed the whole field. And then this horse named Wilco came down the middle of the track after I passed him. I think it was the longest shot in Breeders' Cup history. Paid like $100-some and beat me in that. At that point, you know, the owners kind of had to make a change. You know, they could see. They knew what they had. I knew what we had. And, you know, at that point, I kind of knew my fate was sealed, that I was probably going to lose Alex after that.
Then what happened then? How did you get him back?
Well, I got to ride him in the Mountain Valley at Arkansas. I followed him out there, actually followed Tim Ritchie, and got one of the top agents out there, Gene Short. Johnny B came in to ride him in a Rebel, and I think he was something like 1-2 or 1-5, you know, supposed to be much the best. Finished last in a 6-horse field. It's the only time he's ever been off the board. And he just happened to have a lung infection that day, and I don't know why or how, or, you know, obviously it played into my favor, but, you know, going into Arkansas Derby, he ran that Funker, and Johnny B, at, like he does every year, he has 5 or 6 Derby horses for Todd Fletcher. I think that year, I can't remember who he picked that year, but he went to Bluegrass with him. Bandini, I think it is?
Yeah,
I think
so.
He went to Bluegrass because it was the same day. And I told my agent, Gene, and I think I told Kid, too, at the time, I said, well, if anybody I want to ride Alex is Johnny B, because I knew if he didn't like Alex or Alex didn't run the way he wanted, he was going to have other horse to go to. It wasn't like somebody like Alex was his only horse. He was going to stay with him like I was. He had other opportunities. So I said, well, Tim couldn't pick a better jockey to ride Alex, and if he didn't like, I might have a chance to get him back on. And, you know, Tim went to the owners, and Chuck and Carol Zackney and the Cassius King crew, you know, we were pretty close. I was still riding all their other horses. It's just the big horse, you know, they need a rider change. We talked him in to let me ride the Arkansas Derby, and, of course, he ran one of the fastest Arkansas Derbies in history, lapped the field, blew away everybody, and then we're on to the Derby.
How far did he win the Arkansas Derby, do you remember?
Eight and a half, something like that, I think.
Wow. And so, first Saturday in May comes along, and what are you thinking? Are you confident in what you're working with? Are you maybe overwhelmed by just the experience going on? What are you thinking at this point?
Well, I don't think I was overwhelmed, and I knew what I was setting on. I mean, at this point, you know, I've been around a horse long enough, and I got to ride a decent horse before Alex, a horse named Pocket. So I had a couple horses under me that were runners, not like him, but, you know, I knew what, you know, a decent horse was, and I knew he was a very good horse. And the only thing I could think of in the Derby is I didn't want to get stopped. I didn't want to get hung up behind a bunch of bad horses or something like that. You know, 20-horse field is kind of one of those, if a hole opens up, I felt I should go for it, that type of thing. And that's what kind of cost him the Derby, is I didn't let him run his racing style, which was kind of laid back, mid to behind the pack more than up close. I broke good, and going in the first turn, there was a lot of traffic, but I was sitting in a good spot. And then down the backside, holes starting to open up on the inside. I never wanted to go around horses. I always like to save ground. So when those holes opened up, every time one opened up, I gave him a little leeway to get up in there. And I used them, I think, a little too much, a little too early, too many times, and now the lane's where it costs them.
And Giacomo won that year, is that correct?
Yes, Giacomo. Yes, I still, that's the one race, if there's any race I've ever ridden, that's the one I want back.
Yeah.
Because I knew I had the best horse. You know, hadn't had a Triple Crown in how many years, and I knew that I was the one that cost him the Triple Crown. So, yeah, that one hurt it. And that was, you know, after the Breeders' Cup, that was the longest shot to ever win a Breeders' Cup. And then Giacomo comes back and beats me in the Derby, and that's the longest Derby to ever win. Mm. So,
crazy.
I have those on my resume, too.
But, you know, still ran a heck of a race. And then, and as you mentioned earlier, you know, going into the Preakness, you had to just, you obviously wanted to win that so bad, given that was home.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. That was home. That was family. You know, I had a Campoli, who was a clerk of scales I'm close to. He's now the steward there, and Frankie and everybody down there. I knew them from, you know, my first couple mounts. And that's where I did a lot of winning, made a lot of money, and won a lot of good races. So out of the three Triple Crown races, the Derby was, of course, everybody wants to win a Derby. But to me, the Preakness was the one that I wanted to win.
And then you did win the Belmont as well.
Yeah, it was funny going into Belmont because myself and Mike Smith, I do a lot of interviews, and they kept saying about the rubber match, you know, each have won the rubber match. And I kept thinking, I said, I honestly, if I don't ride a bad race, I don't think it's going to be a horse race. I think this is going to be over a quarter pole.
Wow.
I mean, that's how much confidence I had in Alex. Everybody said, oh, the mile and a half, he can't get it. And I kept looking back at the Preakness going, if I don't trip at the top of the lane, I could go around two more times, you're not going to catch me. I know he can get the mile and a half. It's just a matter of me not calling on him too early. And to be honest, that was the easiest of three races to ride.
Really?
Yeah, by far. Because to be honest, after, you know, mile 16, the horses just can't go that far. They're kind of out of your way, or they're stopping enough that if they're not out of your way, you can move them out of your way. You know, there's only a few horses that are either trained or have the ability to go that far. So by the time we hit the quarter pole, I'd clear sailing.
And describe where you were at prior to the quarter pole. Where did you place him?
Well, I placed him his usual running style. I took him back and dropped him straight to the rail. That was kind of my main thing with Alex, was always get to the rail. And, you know, down the backside, you know, I looked up. We saw a mile ago. Okay, just relax. We got miles. Now your race starts. And we just sat and sat and sat. And I was on, starting to cut through some traffic. And we're about to, when you hit the turn at the Belmont, it's still 5/8 of a mile, where a normal racetrack is 3/8. And I remember telling myself, okay, that's 5/8. Just wait. Just sit. And if you watch the race, I don't move on them till almost the top of the lane. I wait, because I remember at the 5/16 pole, Edgar Prado was outside me. I said, I'm coming out. And I eased him kind of out of the way. I didn't bump him, but I just eased, you know, horses can feel when you got the horse, and they kind of move out of your way. And then I was sitting right outside of Giacomo, and I knew this was going to be over in a flash. It was going to be over quick. And I tapped Alex on his shoulder and threw a double cross, and that was it. Then he did his little run, and I called it.
It was all over after that. 1/7, yep. I think, that day.
Yep, and that was, you know, eased up inside the 16th hole.
Wow. Incredible.
I think somebody said it was one of the fastest 3/8s in Belmont history when 3/8s pull in. I mean, he really had a turn of foot that, I mean, would rip a heart out of a horse.
That's amazing. And I don't remember. So that was the last race he ran. What did they do with him after that?
He ended up having just a small fracture in his foot, and it just didn't heal fast enough that, you know, to insure a horse like that, I think they were saying it was like $200,000 a month, something outrageous, just to insure him. And, you know, they're getting offers from everyone that wanted him at stud. So, you know, Cassius King found Gainsway, who, from everything I've heard, has been great to everybody. They've certainly been great to me. You know, they've offered us a house. We want to go see Alex. We can stay in the house. So if that's where Alex is, he's at stud at Gainsway with some, I think Tappet's even at Gainsway, I want to say. But there's some really good horses at Gainsway, and that's where he's been at stud since 2006, I think.
And have you gotten to see him?
Oh, yeah. For a couple of years, I went down every year to see him. I haven't been in the Kentucky circuit or ridden on those racetracks for a while, so I haven't got to see him the last couple of years. But I used to go down every year. He looks the same, just a big old neck and got that stallion neck now. I mean, he's a big boy now. Still loves his peppermints.
He's living life right now.
Yeah, he loves life. Has his own room. His stall looks like a little 4-star hotel. I mean, it's enormous. It's got little pads all over it. I mean, he deserves it. You know, he paid his way for that.
Jockey Jeremy Rose joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Jeremy, I think it's safe to assume he's probably on the top of your list as far as favorite horses you've ridden.
He's by far my favorite.
Yeah, by far, right. Who else do you consider some of your best horses you've ridden?
Well, it depends on how you... A lot of people ask me this, and it depends on horses I've sat on or which ones have done well for me. Haverty Grace, obviously, I went a lot of good races with her. It was either first and second. She went on to be horse of the year. She was probably right there with the best horses I've ridden. But I broke manes on Big Brown, which obviously we know. Game on Dude, mm-hmm. Round Pond. I mean, there's quite a few. Grace Hall. So it's hard to say which one ended up being the best that I've ridden, but the ones that were the best for me, as in I got to stay with, were the Fleet Alex and Haverty Grace.
What about Ben's Cat?
Ben's Cat is a fan favorite, and definitely those three, when they asked me, those are the three that pop up. Ben's Cat was one of those that he was an iron horse. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I got lucky to ride him, I would say, at the peak of his career. And he was a quirky horse. He'd mess with you a little bit.
That's what I heard, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, now, it was funny. I never worked him. I got to ride him. I think I went 8 out of 9 on him, or 7 out of 8 or something, multiple grade stakes, all that. And I think the year that I rode him, we wanted to go to the Breeders' Cup, but he had to supplement him. But I would have been 1-2 in the Breeders' Cup that year in the 5-8 sprint. But I remember I went the second Maryland Million on him. And everybody always told me about how he drops the riders in the morning, this and that, blah, blah, blah. But I never had a problem with him. He was always great to ride, easy to ride. You set back. He's my kind of horse, a closing sprinter. You pick your time. You pick your way through traffic, and he had that kick. So I always had fun with him. So we're galloping out, and I'm thinking after the Maryland Million, I just went out. I said, all right, we're getting ready for the Breeders' Cup from here. And I'm telling you, Christina, you could have told me where he was going to try to drop me. Told me what he was going to do, and I wouldn't have stayed on his back. He ducked out for me so fast, he was just gone. I landed on my feet. He spun me upside down, laying on my feet, and I'm standing there looking at him, holding the reins as he's backing up to the pond at Laurel Park. And right now, I'm scared to death. He's going into the pond, and I'm going with him because I'm not letting go of this horse before the Breeders' Cup. And that's how quick and how fast he was at that and his turn of foot. It was one that you could always count on running. And that's what King was saying, King Leatherbury, why he didn't want to retire him, because he always showed up. He was a horse that always showed up 1, 2, 3. So you could tell at the end of his career he wasn't the same. When he wouldn't hit the board, it was just time catching up.
Right, but you could tell he was a horse that he really did love what he did.
He loved racing.
And didn't I hear as well, like, you couldn't get to the front too soon, or he'd start, you know, looking around trying to duck again? Yeah, right, pull up, yeah.
The only time that he ever did that to me, and he didn't get beat, he still won, was that race I was talking about. I kind of hit the front too early, and his ears came straight up, and he was never going to let a horse come by me, but you could tell he'd make you think about it, and that's for sure. He was one I'd always try to keep covered up as long as I could, because all I needed was 3/16 of a mile, mm-hmm. and then, you know, he was going to get by whoever was in front. I remember at Penn National, I believe it's the Governor's Cup, I think it is, the 5/8 up there, the big one, 250 or 300. I was stuck in between horses, and, you know, it looked like I was in trouble, but really it was working out to my benefit, because once it opened up, I only had a 1/16 of the go. He ran up through and split horses and win by neck, and that was how he always won. He liked to win by a neck and a head, and I think the crowd enjoyed that. You know, you always have you gasping for air, and then he'd get up the last couple strides.
Yeah, of course. It's more exciting, and he doesn't have to do as much work. So,
and I think that's what kept him sound, and I think that's what helps turf horses also and closing horses, is if you don't have to do all the work early, you last longer. You know, speed kills. It's fun to watch, but in the end, it catches up with you, and I think that's what kept him sound for so long, is he only had to run a quarter of a mile, and it was always on turf. So it kept him going until he's, 10 years old?
Yeah. He was a great one. That's for sure. Yeah. Now, what about Bulls Bay? Won the Whitney in 2009.
Yeah, Bulls Bay was one of those that I always told Graham he's an overachiever. You know, he never was really given that grade one talent or superstar talent, but he runs through a wall for you to try to win. And he's one that, you know, he came into Maryland, and I think I ran second in the stake, and then he just won it, kind of peaked the right time, in the right time period where he was, going into the wood and all that. And the Whitney, you know, I had a lot of confidence in the Whitney because the race down in Churchill, I got hung out wide on both turns, real wide. I was 4 wide, I think, the whole way around. I ran fourth by a length. You know, on paper, it doesn't look good. But when you're sitting on their back, you're thinking, if I could have saved ground at any point or done anything different, this could have changed. And a lot of the horses came from that race up to the Whitney. And, you know, I think I told Kid before the race, I said, this is a livest 25-1 shot I've ridden in a long time. I really had a lot of confidence that at least he would hit the board. I knew that it was a tough race. It's a grade one at 750, but I had confidence that he was going to run his race. And we got a nice hot pace out in front of us, and I actually hit the lead a little early. I hit the lead at the quarter pole, and he's one that you don't want to take the lead on too early either, but he had so much momentum and such a big stride that they couldn't run him down.
Wow, and what did he pay that day?
I think he was 28-1, so $56, $57, something like that, just under 60.
That had to be exciting, yeah. But you weren't even, you weren't even thinking that, oh, wow, I'm on a long shot. You had an idea that you would win.
I had an idea he'd at least hit. I knew he wasn't going to embarrass us. He was going to be 1, 2, 3, you know, whether he could win. You know, sometimes as grade ones, your horse just isn't good enough. But, you know, I felt he was going to run the best race he could run that day. And he came back in the wood and ran a big race. I mean, we hooked Rachel Alexander at the top of the lane.
Yeah.
And that was just a monster. I mean, you take her out, we might have won the wood, too. She was just, she was tough.
Oh, my gosh. Incredible. And yeah, but he wasn't too shabby either.
everything he
did as well. But you mentioned a couple of times my kind of horse. You mentioned as far as referring to Ben's Cat, the closing sprinter, and I always found that provided more of a rush to close on the field, turning for home. And how would you describe your riding style then, Jeremy? Would you prefer coming from off the pace like that?
Well, my riding style, I've always said, is more what the horse is comfortable doing, what they want to do. I have no problem being on the lead if that's what the horse wants. I think it's all a matter of doing what's easiest for the horse to get the most out of the horse. But in my, what I'd like to ride is mid-pack closing horses on the turf is my favorite. Because I think turf, I don't think jockeys make a whole lot of difference, honestly. If I'm being honest, I think we make 5% difference, something like that. But I think the turf, you can make a little bit more of a difference on the turf just because you have to save more ground, you have to know when to make your move, and it's a lot tighter. So those are my favorite races to ride, a mid-pack on the turf, you know, making that closing run. Those are my favorite.
Yeah, the turf is definitely a lot different as far as just reaction time as well. I always noticed, you know, you give a horse a cue to turn, you know, it takes a little more effort on the dirt because I guess of that hindrance of the dirt, and they're just skipping over the grass. Seems like everything happens a lot faster.
And I think that's why a lot of racetracks don't like 10-pound bugs or first races to be on the turf, because you're right. I think, you know, on the dirt, it's harder for a horse to get a hold. It breaks out. Everything doesn't happen as quick. Where the turf, everything's very rapid. Everything's very quick. So you have to know where you're at a little bit better than on the dirt. And that's what I mean by, I think on the turf, a jockey can make a little bit more of a difference than he can on the dirt.
So Jeremy, we only have about like 3 minutes left. Like I said, this is flying by. We might have to have you back on the show again, but tell us now, you know, you're going back to your roots, Delaware Park. What are your immediate career goals that you have for yourself now?
Well, my goal at any racetrack is always to be a leading rider. I think every jockey has that goal, and if you don't, I don't know why you're in the game. So obviously, get through the meet without any injuries. That would be a big plus. And, you know, have a good meet. Have a good, clean meet where we ride well, we get good mouths. You know, John Service put me on one for Saturday, which is great to see. Chucky Lawrence, actually, John's horse is Cash's King horse. So that was cool to see, because I've talked to Carol a little bit, but I haven't seen Duck for a couple of years, so that was great to see. So it's going in the right direction.
Nice.
We just got to get more horses there.
Do you plan to travel a lot, or are you pretty much just focused on Delaware Park right now?
Well, we're focused for that as our main meet, but, you know, 4 days a week, you know, races come up other places. We'll be in Maryland on Friday, so wherever the whole races are, kid will pick them out. He's always been the one that does that, and Half-pack will travel.
I love it. And Kid, as you mentioned before, you guys had so much success together really quickly. Tell us, why do you think that is? Why do you guys make such a good team?
I think we have the same kind of personality. We get along. You know, he's been like a brother or father to me. I had him for 11 years, like a marriage. A lot of marriages don't last that long. Yeah. We work well together, and we listen to each other for the most part. You know, every agent and jockey have arguments, but for the most part, and I trust him. That's a huge thing, I think, for agents, especially for me. You have to trust your agent because it's dangerous. You don't want an agent just going to thin you out on anything. You want them to know that, you know, your safety is involved. So that's a huge thing, is I trust kids.
Well, and you've been pretty lucky with injuries, yeah?
Yeah, I did get injured pretty good. It was misdiagnosed. I broke a couple of vertebrae and cracked a collarbone and was still riding. But other than that, I've been pretty lucky. I didn't have to take a whole lot of time off for injuries.
Well, Jeremy, we are all out of time. Wishing you all the best. Stay safe. Get to the winner's circle often. We'll be watching. And thank you so much for joining us tonight, Jeremy.
Thank you very much. It's been fun. I appreciate it.
Folks, you can check out this show and replays of all of our other shows on the website at horseracingradio.net. While you're there, check out all of the other great shows you can find here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, like Trainer Talk, Equine Forum, and Express Bet Radio. Be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.